You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Hey everyone, welcome to Page to Stage,
a conversation with theater makers.
We're your hosts.
That's Brian.
And that's Mary.
This episode is part of our series on A Beautiful Noise, the Neil Diamond musical.
In this series, we're looking at how certain design elements shape the creative process of a new musical, particularly one based on a true story.
We hope you enjoy this episode.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFF's creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFF's The Original New Musical from Shayna Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Hi, my name is Brian Usifer, and I'm an arranger, orchestrator, and music director. On Beautiful Noise specifically, I am the dance arranger, the incidental music arranger, and I co-orchestrate with Sonny Paladino and Bob Gaudio.
Lots of hats.
Lots of hats. It's a nice, big, happy family we have.
It is. And we just spoke with Anne Marie not too long ago. And just talking about the dream team that is the music department for this show. I mean, it's got to be pretty surreal with everyone involved in general. But specifically, the music department just seems to have a really strong group. So I'm excited to get your perspective on that. To kick us off, though, I actually wanted to ask you, what would you say would be like the biggest difference between all the different roles that you've held, you know, music director, orchestrator, arranger, composer? You know, is there anything that really sticks out for each of those individual roles?
You know, in the Venn diagram of it, they all sort of overlap in a couple different ways. I think that to me, I separate them in something that is sort of more on the performance and management side, which is like music supervisors, music directors, versus writing. You know, I don't want to use the term creative because everything that we do is creative. But when you're arranging or orchestrating, you're writing. You're writing music to some extent. You know, whether you're using somebody's existing music as you do with arranging, or coming up with your own lines as it is in orchestrating. You know, it is writing. So I kind of talk about it in those two different ways, and I've done it where I am all those things. I've done it where I'm just some of the things. this is a team that is large. There's a lot of us, and we all kind of have our little compartmentalized things. But at the same time, we all kind of do, we work together. Like, it's a real true collaboration. And when we first started out, you know, we talked about that a lot and talked about just like that being there for each other and being each other's sounding boards, and that nobody can, you know, you don't have to say, oh, I can't have that idea because that's somebody else's sandbox. Like, we're kind of all in the sandbox. Ultimately, it's, you know, whoever's responsibility to come up with the final idea or say like, okay, this is what it's going to be. But Sunny and Anne-Marie and I, and in some cases Bob, all work together, you know, in a sort of circle of ideas, which is really fun. And I love collaborating. And when you are the person that does all of it, it's easy because you don't have to deal with anybody. But it's also like lonely because it's like, oh man, I had this idea that who am I going to bounce it off? I guess it's the cast. I guess I'm going to like go to work and try this in front of everybody. Whereas when you're collaborating, it's a lot of like phone calls and voice memos and like, hey, what about this? Or no, I actually don't think that works, but it could be this. I really find that fun. I think that's a really, to me, the most fun way to work.
I think what's so unique about this particular process versus other arrangers or orchestrators that we've had on Page to Stage is the fact that you're not necessarily working with a composer. People are already aware of the music coming into this. From a perspective of how you're brought onto a project like this, and using this as an example, who's assembling the team and who brought you on, and how do you, and at what point do you come on for your particular portion of the work of the process?
Right. I was brought on by Michael Mayer, the director. Sunny had already been working on the show and had done a good amount of work, and they did a reading. They had a full score. Michael and I had worked together on some things, and he asked if I would come on and bring my perspective and, you know, my ideas to this. And I knew Sunny and I had not worked together, like officially, I don't think that I can think of, but we knew each other just from, you know, the playground. And we had like a substantial conversation before I really came on, just about like, what could this be, and what, how could we work together, and what would be the best way to move forward? And we kind of, I think, built a strong, you know, collaborative foundation to begin with, which I think has been really successful for this. But, you know, it, a lot of the time it's the producer. Sometimes it is the composer. Sometimes it, you know, I've gotten brought onto projects by like everybody. It's, you know, you just never know when somebody's be like, oh, you know, who's really right for this, Brian. And so it really can kind of come from anywhere, but Michael and I have, you know, a working relationship. We've done some other things together. We're currently doing some other things together. And having that shorthand is good when you're doing, when you're developing musicals, when you don't really have a lot of time, you know, and you have to kind of make things happen quickly.
So what were some of those earlier conversations like? I mean, as Brian said, obviously the music already exists. And so then the conversation, I'm assuming, is just like, how can we musicalify it, if you will, or like, how can we, you know, use the music that already exists to then tell the story that's written in the book?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, really, the name of the game is storytelling. Like, in every aspect of what we do, we approach it from a place of storytelling, because that is really what we're trying to do with theater. And, you know, you can come up with an arrangement idea or an orchestration idea, but really I always go back to, what is the story? What is this? What are we trying to say here? What are we trying to do? What are the characters trying to do? You know, when you think about original musicals, that's what the composer is doing, right? That the composer is like getting inside the brain of each character and saying, okay, this person is in this situation and this is what they want, and this is how they're going to sing it to get that. And so when you're working on a catalog musical, you kind of have to be that person and be the person that's asking those questions and trying to come up with, you know, what those ideas can be. In a show like this, which is a bio musical, it's a little bit of a double challenge, because there are moments when the music is diegetic, right? When it's Neil Diamond actually performing music. And when that's happening, you know, there's a little less creative freedom there, because the idea is that it sounds like when Neil Diamond sings, you know, whatever the song is, Sweet Caroline or you know, Kentucky Woman, which actually we sort of reimagined a little bit, so it's not a great example. But, you know, knowing in this show whether the music is diegetic versus dramatic is like the first question that we kind of have to ask. Because when it's used in a dramatic way, that opens up the whole conversation of like, okay, well, what is it? What would this sound like? Like, what do I need this music to do in order to function as a piece of storytelling in this moment? And then you kind of like go crazy with it and you'd come up with all the different ideas and try to figure out, you know, what that would sound like. And then it kind of congeals into something that is like obviously a Neil Diamond song, but approached in a different way and approached from a different character's perspective and from a different character's voice. That's actually my favorite thing about this project. I've done a couple catalog musicals and all of them have been original stories where the world is sort of your oyster from an arrangement standpoint. You can, you know, reimagine any song. And that's fun for me. I mean, I think that's why an arranger would want to do a catalog musical. But in this case, since it's both, there's just so much creative freedom there and so many ways to kind of play with that storytelling and play with the language.
So you brought up obviously catalog musical as a term, and then biomusical is another term. And I just, I guess for our listeners out there, you probably have heard jukebox musical as probably the more like front runner of the three terms. And I'm curious are you saying catalog musical in the sense of like a jukebox musical, but just like as a more broader term?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I feel like, I have like an agenda by using that term.
It felt very purposeful, you know?
Yeah, well, and it is what I use and how I talk about it, because I think that jukebox musical has become a pejorative term. You know, I think it's become a term that people sort of look down on or turn their nose up at. And, you know, I'm not going to make a judgment on the validity of these kinds of musicals because it's not my job to do that right now. But talking about it in a way that isn't pejorative, I think is important for the creative team, because we have to like be on board with this idea and drink this Kool-Aid and be like, yes, we're doing this show and we're doing it like it's a new musical, because that's the approach that we're kind of taking. And I do think that in 2022, jukebox is not like the thing. I mean, like, I know what a jukebox is, but like,
sounds dusty and archaic, and there's already a negative, an old, dusty connotation that I think would go along with it.
Right. I mean, it's more like if the term didn't exist today, somebody would probably call it a playlist musical, right? Like, if it didn't exist, that's like how we consume music today, is like with playlists. And so that would probably be the term. And, you know, catalog in this case is kind of the right thing, because we are really drawing from all the songs in the Neil Diamond catalog, which is different than, say, you know, American Idiot, for example, which is a concept album. And the songs, I think actually they brought in a couple different songs, but like the idea of American Idiot is that it's that album, right? It's not like every Green Day song ever written. It's what they wrote for that album. And bio, you know, by bio, like I say, that it's about the person, or it's about a person, you know, the performer. Whereas like I've done shows that use the catalog of certain artists, but it's not about those artists at all. It actually has nothing to do with them.
Yeah, like Mamma Mia, I would argue, is like in that vein of not musical. But
and that was really the first,
work.
You know, I mean, that, you know, Moulin Rouge came before Mamma Mia. Moulin Rouge was obviously a movie, not a musical, but like Moulin Rouge was really the first thing to like break open the genre in a way that used existing songs, you know, as storytelling devices. And then on Broadway, Mamma Mia this is sort of what people think. I mean, I'm sure somebody's going to fact check me and say that I'm wrong, but like, you know, we think of Mamma Mia as being the first, you know, jukebox or catalog musical to hit Broadway, because it was fully existing songs, but with a totally different story that was not related to the songs themselves.
In terms of the process of kind of just getting started with the project and how you're going to approach certain songs, did you ever have conversations, or I guess were conversations needed to be had with Neil Diamond about how things were going to be reorchestrated or arranged and used within the context of the musical? Or were all those permissions and kind of like waived when, you know, the rights were acquired to do this?
I think that from our perspective, the permissions are waived. However, Bob Gaudio is kind of there to be the protector of that, right? Like Bob, in a lot of ways, is the direct link to Neil. And so we look to Bob in when we have questions. If there's something that's like, well, maybe this is like a little too crazy, I think Bob is like a good arbiter of those things. But really, you know, I not to like sound like a Boy Scout, but I think that like coming on to a project like this, you know that you have a responsibility to honor the artist and to honor what the artist is about. And a lot of that is like getting inside what you think is the brain of the artist based on their music and like where, you know, organizing that into like choices and ideas and things that exist in their catalog and in their performance style that feel like they're fair game versus things that are like, this does not feel like Neil Diamond to me. This feels like something totally different. And sometimes using that to an effect, using that to sort of make it sound different on purpose. You know, but we do talk about that. We talk about, we meaning like Sonny and Anne-Marie and I, we talk about like, oh, that feels not really Neil Diamond, or this is like, this feels right down the pocket, you know, not to like, I don't know where this conversation is going, but not to skip ahead. But when we were orchestrating the show, for Boston, one of the things that I did was listen to every single live performance I could find of every single song over like the 40 years that he toured, you know, and that to me, I was downloading all of the like nuances of the styles as they changed through the decades and like how his band changes, how they play it and how the players influence it and how, you know, the horn lines in one song are this and in another they're that. And sometimes there's not horns at all. There are strings instead, you know, and kind of looking at all of those different choices and those different ideas and then organizing them into like, okay, this is useful, this is not useful. I don't have something here, so I'm going to write something that doesn't exist. And that was, you know, the approach for the orchestration. So in a lot of ways, the orchestrations of this show really encapsulate like his entire career as a performer, because some of the ideas are from recordings from the 60s, and some of them are from like the concert in 2009 that he did, you know, that his band is playing, and they have this little nuance that they add that it's like, oh, that's cool, that's interesting, how can we kind of use that and pull this into the world?
Yeah, I was curious, when do you figure out and assemble? Because like you mentioned, you know, depending on what tour it is, depending on what period of an artist's career, they play around with those things when they're actually performing, when they're recording in studios, and when they have the means to do so. So I'm wondering, how did you assemble the orchestrations and kind of figure out what your band is going to look like?
Yeah, the band makeup was something that we had a lot of conversations about. Broadway theaters have minimums, right? There's a union minimum of number of musicians. So when you know that you're going into, you know, the St. James or the O'Neill or whatever theater, you know that there's a number that you have to sort either be at or, you know, be above or be below. There's different circumstances for that to happen, but knowing the like ballpark of that is a good way to start, which is where we began. And we, you know, after a lot of different conversations, we ended up with the number 12, which incidentally is the minimum in the Broadhurst. But with 12 musicians, we have two keyboards, two guitars, bass, drums, percussion, two strings, and three horns, which is a great band because you can kind of do anything with that ensemble. You know, you can really shift gears and go into the string world, or you can go into the big horns world, or you can have the reed player playing flute and the trumpet player plays flugelhorn, and suddenly it sounds like 1963, you know. And two keyboards, two guitars, and Will Swenson plays guitar a lot in the show too. So a lot of the time it's kind of three guitars. But really the question was like, what's the palette? What are all the different kinds of sounds that we need to make and the different decades, that we have to represent? And that band is, you know, a real good indication of how to do all that. And then, you know, in terms of assembling the ideas, you know, it, like I said, I listened to all of the different live recordings and the original recordings, and really, again, it all goes back to like, what's the story? What is this song trying to accomplish? What's the story of the song? How does the sound of it have to build in order to support that? You know, I like to think of characters as having timbres and tones to, the bad example of that is like Peter and the Wolf, you know, where each character has its own like instrument in the orchestra. But there's something fun to play with that idea. A lot of the time in this show, when Neil then is singing, there's cello involved as like a complement to his kind of low voice. You know, we wanted to kind of lean into that rather than do something that felt like it was an opposition to it. Whereas like a lot of the time when it's Marcia, played by Robin Herter, it's like strings and flugelhorns, and like in her big number, it kind of goes above that and gets bigger. But you know, flute, that kind of thing, like Play Me, has a lot of like flute and like string parts in it. So a lot of it was just like, how do we complement the character singing the song, and also how do we tell the story? And then sometimes it's like, this just has to sound like the record, and that's what we did. And that's, you know, it's fun to be able to do that, because like when they, like Sweet Caroline is Sweet Caroline, like we all agreed like that's what it was going to be. And when you hear the band play that, it's like, it's very exciting and very satisfying to hear the band play, and it sounds like Sweet Caroline. It doesn't sound like we came up with some crazy idea for Sweet Caroline. You know, it's like, it really delivers the song in the way that you expect from an orchestration standpoint. I'm not saying that that's what the staging is. I'm not saying that that's what the story is. I think that's all, that all has its like its merit and its value, and I love how it happens in the show. But we decided like from the orchestration that we were just going to do Sweet Caroline, and that's one of the songs that kind of gets that like honor of, this is exactly what it needs to be.
So I'm curious, in that same, I guess, mindset of what you're just talking about, also you have to, I guess, be concerned with the time period, right? So like over time. So I have seen the production. I saw it in Boston. It was a long, it feels like it was a lifetime ago now. So like my memory is a little foggy, but I, like, you know, you go through the, you know, his career essentially. And so I'm sure there's different sounds of that, either that time period or specifically Neil in that time period. And so I'm curious as to how that played into the decisions that you were making for orchestrations.
Yeah, a lot. You know, the most of the first act is like in the 60s. And so that kind of informed a lot of decisions in terms of how, like what the guitars are doing, what the guitar sounds are, what the strings are doing, what the horns are doing. You know, there are moments when we really wanted to lean into like the 60s of it all. Like there's a little Peter, Paul and Mary callback in one of the songs. And Kentucky Woman, especially because the way that it's set in the show, it's really early. It's early in his career. I mean, it's before he's quote unquote Neil Diamond. And so we went with a different sound with that, that again uses like a lot of sounds of like 60s sort of pop rock. You know, there's like, I think there's even like some celeste and glockenspiel in there and flute and strings. And, you know, it really has that like, that light, airy and like relentlessly positive sound to it. It's a really like bright, you know, beautiful kind of thing that has this band underneath it that's like acoustic guitars, really like acoustic guitar based. You know, and there's like a little bit of piano and like some organ, but no like synthesizers, none of that kind of stuff. As we get into the second act, obviously the second act starts in the 70s and goes like kind of through that period. And so, you know, the guitars are more electric, the horns are like rock and roll horns, like playing like cool ripping lines like he would have in his stadium concerts. You hear some synthesizer in the keyboards, not a lot because it's not like a huge thing in his music, although America has that like signature synth sound, which we don't do until the bows actually. But then my favorite part of the show is kind of like the last third of the show, where it goes into like a memory play almost, where we have things like Brooklyn Roads and America and Shiloh, which is really a whole like memory play sequence. And that was, to me, the most fun to orchestrate because there were no rules to it, right? It wasn't diegetic. It wasn't like really storytelling and narrative. It was really like essentially getting inside Neil Now's emotions as he's living them, as he's kind of like going through this in the doctor's office. I don't know how much I'm allowed to give away on this, but I guess I'm, you know, I'm going not all the way with it, but that's it. That's its own different sound too. You know, like that is a real, it goes like really orchestral in some of those moments. Like that's where I wish I had like 30 strings. You know, there's like sort of Aaron Copland-esque moments in America and Brooklyn Roads that we do that are really meant to just like make it seem, you know, grounded and emotional, but also like it's coming from this other place. Like it's not Neil Diamond as we know Neil Diamond, right? It's coming from a totally different part of his emotion and his psyche, which is what the show's doing. It's like that. It goes back to, we ask the question, what's the story here? What's going on? And so that was the beginning of those decisions and how we decided to score it.
I was going to say, just to give people some context, do you remember about what year and how long you've been on this process?
I'm pretty sure the first thing I did was in March of 2020, and our last day was like March 11th or whatever, like the day the Broadway world shut down.
Because they like had just did a workshop right before then, I believe.
That's right? Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And I came on like right after that. Actually, no. Yeah, no, that's the one. We did like a sort of vocal and movement workshop in March of 2020, and they had just done a reading before that. So yeah, it was right then that I sort of came in. And then, yeah, so I guess it's been 2 years, which is kind of like not a lot of time. Like I have shows that are not open yet that I've been working on for 3-4 years. I mean, it can range, but I certainly, I think 2 years is kind of a short period, which is great. I mean, that's what, like, when it goes, it goes. And like, that's the best way to do it. It's, you know, the momentum of like having an out of town tryout and knowing your Broadway theater is amazing, because you can really gauge how you work. I've been lucky. At Kinky Boots and Frozen were both that for me, where we knew from our out of town what the Broadway show schedule was going to be. And we had a theater. And so it gives you the gift of time and the gift of perspective and knowing like we're going to get a whole other crack at this when we do it on Broadway.
Now, we've been hearing, even though, yeah, you did know where you were going as soon as Boston was finished. Actually, you knew well before that even. But so I'm sure that kind of made your original process more productive, because you knew we weren't going to have to go back and do a ton of rewriting. But we've heard from just our guests in this series alone that there have been quite a few rewrites, or that they're still working on some things of just kind of tightening things here, because we know that there was a hiatus during the Boston run because of COVID. So a lot of things that maybe you would have adjusted or noted during previews were cut short, unfortunately. So I'm curious as to what the process has been like now that you've had a couple of months in between, close in August, you will have a couple of months before rehearsals start in the next few weeks or so. So I'm curious what that's been like for you.
Even before the hiatus, I had started making like a wish list of things for Broadway, things that I knew like we weren't going to really have time or it wasn't worth spending the energy on in Boston. And then when that hiatus happened, it was like, oh, we're not going to get a lot of time, so let's really like make a list here and try to figure out what that is. And, you know, and then I had conversations with Michael about what his ideas were and what he needed from us in terms of any arranging changes. And so we kind of came up with this big list of like, here's what we'd like to do. With some arrangement things, with some orchestration things, with some changing the way that some of the casting, some things, you know, stuff that we just like need rehearsal time for. And so, yeah, that master list has kind of been like the guiding force. You know, one of the great things about doing the cast album in between is that we had to do all of the wish list things for the orchestration. So before we went into the studio, we went back in. And at many phone calls of Sonny and I, of just like figuring out what we were going to implement, how we were going to do it. Because Sonny and I don't always agree on everything. And that's like totally great. And I enjoy that. And we always come out with a solution. And so once we figured out what we were going to do, we went through and made all of those changes. So the list is a lot smaller now than it was when we left Boston, which is nice, because going into rehearsals, there are a couple of things that we're definitely changing in the arranging department, but I feel like we've hit all of the orchestration notes, which is nice. And we've met and heard the New York band who played on the album, which is great. And that, you know, different people are different people. So going from a band in Boston to the band in New York, everything feels different, you know? And so you have to sort of recalibrate, like, oh, this is, now I have to like kind of rebalance this in a different way, or oh, actually this could be something else now that I hear how this person plays it. And our band in Boston was incredible. So it's not about that. It's just different humans play things differently. And once you kind of get them together, you have a different sense of how it's going
to
be.
I want to ask you about dance arrangements, but actually first, I forgot to mention this when we were chatting with Anne Marie. So one of the things that like immediately took me away was the fact there's an overture, which I feel like we haven't really heard in a new musical in like so long. And it's just, it's also because everyone knows the music. And so you hear like the different tunes of all the different popular songs, and obviously mixed in with one songs you may not know. And then also maybe just from some of the arrangements that you've added in. So I'm curious as to like what that process looks like when kind of putting together an overture, specifically one with notable music.
And I'll say too, I don't know if everybody knows this, but incidental music arrangements, which is one of my titles, is all of, it's like the overture, the on-track, scene change music, underscore, music for the bows, music for the, you know, when the band does, when the band keeps playing and people walk out of the music, we call it exit music. If in tech we need a scene change, I have to run down the aisle and sit at the piano and like figure it out and make it up on the spot and hopefully it's good. And if not, I'll fix it later. But, you know, that's like that is the main part of that part of my job, and kind of being responsible for those things. And so, you know, when you do readings and stuff, you don't need a lot of that. You don't need a lot of transitional music, and nobody wants to hear an overture in a reading. Unfortunately, we did a workshop actually back in October, and I really advocated for an entr'acte, which is the music. It's like the overture before the second act. It's what plays to kind of get people back in their seats and to re-energize the air in the room. And for that, we use Crunchy Granola Suite from the Live at the Greek recording from the 70s, because it's just like a great arrangement, and we sort of adapted it for our use. But the you know, energy of that is what that idea was. And so for the overture, many, many conversations were had about its necessity, and many conversations were had about what it should be and what it could be. And I'll spare you what all the conversations were, but ultimately we decided that it would be nice to have something. And really what it does is it's a little bit of a bait and switch in that it sets up a big Neil Diamond concert, right? It makes the audience think that they're at a giant like stadium Neil Diamond concert. And then the show starts and it isn't that. And so that really informed what it should be. And we kind of based it on in the original version of America, there's like an orchestral introduction that's like really gorgeous and beautiful. And that was kind of like, okay, well, what if that's kind of like the backbone of it? What if that's like the bones, and how can we make that feel like it's the beginning of something and leading up to something else, right? It has to feel like something is starting and it's like, okay, here we go. And then I'm taking you on this ride. So it starts as this big sort of fanfare of America and then kind of goes through a couple different keys. And so we kind of hear, you know, it feels like we're moving through time, I think, in my brain, which is what all the key changes are, is that we're kind of going through like this period, and then we change keys, we're going here, and then we're going here, and then everything just cuts out abruptly. In a lot of traditional overtures, you'll hear like four or five different songs from the show. And for this, it's really just America the whole way through. But it kind of like it spins it sideways and turns on its head a couple times to make you feel like that it's something different. But it was fun. I have not gotten to do a lot of overtures because people typically don't like them, but I just think it's so fun. And I really, I'm like a purist with a lot of things like that. And when we were working on Book of Mormon, we didn't have one at all. There was like there's a prologue in the show where it kind of like sets up everything before hello. And then I think it was actually in tech, when they added like a full like fanfare sort of introduction thing. And it's so effective and it's so exciting. And as an audience member and an orchestra player, it's like, yes, we should do that. So I'm glad we ended up sticking with it.
Is there someone that, whether it's you or someone else on the team that would really kind of fight for that or bring that up? Or is that something that is, I guess I'm just trying to be curious. I'm curious as to how the conversation is even approached, you know, is it you're fighting for it and you're, you know, offering it up as like, I really think we should be adding this? Or is it coming from the director of like, I think something's missing, or I really don't want this at all? Like, how is that discussed?
Yeah. In this case, we pitched it to Michael. I mean, like Sonny and I talked, and Bob, we all sort of like talked about what it, you know, should we have it and what should it be? And then we had to pitch that to Michael. And, you know, with all of these things, we always go to Michael. I mean, Michael is such an incredible director and has such a vision. And when we have ideas and want to try things, you know, we don't suppose that he's just going to be like, great, I love it. You know, it's a conversation. It's always a conversation. And so usually what we'll do is we'll come up with an idea and we'll call Michael and he'll have opinions and ideas and we'll go back and forth. And there's always a shaping there and it's always exciting. I mean, Michael's very musical and he understands music and he loves music, which is nice because it's not, I don't ever really have to fight for music per se. It's a matter of like, for him, what is it? What is it doing? What is the story? So it's a lot of the same questions that we kind of ask as well. But yeah, in that case, it was really a question for Michael. And I know that in some ways, Michael didn't envision it starting with that. And so it was like, let's try this and see how it works.
I wanted to talk about dance arrangements because we have not actually really dived into that on the podcast specifically. And I guess just to kind of open the door for our listeners, could you just explain really like where you start with dance arrangements?
Dance arrangements are essentially music that is meant to support the choreography. Every choreographer is different, and really the dance arranger is there to help support their ideas and to help support their movement. How that happens is very different from person to person and from show to show. I've worked as a dance arranger with choreographers where we create, you know, full elaborate dance breaks that have like multiple sections and move through keys and time signatures and tempo changes and everything. And then I've worked with choreographers that it's kind of within like the framework of the songs that are there already. And on this show in particular, because it's the style of it doesn't feel musical theater, right? Like the show feels theatrical. The show is theatrical in a lot of ways, but it doesn't ever feel like musical theater in the sense where, I don't know, a dance number is sort of crafted as like a storytelling device in like a massive way, right? There are two really big moments in the show that are like dance moments, and that's the dance break in Stadium Medley and the dance break in Forever in Blue Jeans. And actually in Stadium Medley, Stephen Hoggett came over to me and said, I don't think I've ever asked for a dance break before, but I think we need a dance break here. And I was like, that's what I'm here for. So let's talk about it. And so we had a conversation about, you know, how long, it's always like, how long do you want it to be? I mean, that like, we can kind of start there. And if there is an answer, it's like a choose your own adventure. If there is an answer of like, well, you know, 30 seconds or 5 minutes, or it's a dream ballet, that helps kind of like frame what it's going to be and frame the scope of it. And in this case, you know, it was like, this is like a 30 second, you know, maybe like 8 counts of 8 or 16 counts of 8 or something like that. And it's the dancers, you know, on stage in the Neil Diamond concert that are kind of like like the energy explodes out of Neil and out of the song, and they sort of embody that. But it's part diegetic too. I mean, they like the way that it looks like there are people in his concert that are on stage with him. So, you know, the way that I approached it in that case was, I didn't really want to go too far outside of the song. And so we're in Crunchy Granola there. And so the vocabulary of what Crunchy Granola is, there's the verses and there's the choruses and there's kind of like the guitar line. And so, you know, I look at it and say, okay, what are my Legos here? Like, what are the puzzle pieces that I can work with? What are the melodies? What are the harmonies? What are the different sections of the song? And when we worked on it in October in the workshop, Stephen also had this idea that as the break progresses, it gets like hotter and distorted and like almost just like gnarly in like good ways. I'm trying to find like a positive adjective for this, but like, you know, I don't know. I think distorted, juicy. Yeah, I say distorted, but like that's not the right term. But I loved that idea because that also gave me a shape, right? That gave me something to kind of like build to. Because when it starts at 10. You know, that's another thing too. A lot of dance breaks, you know, start and they pull back so that they have somewhere to go, or somewhere in the middle of them they drop back so that you can have somewhere to go. But this like is right out of the gate, like at a 10. So it's like, how do we sustain 10? For this entire break, and then when they come back in, it's like 11. But I played with the idea of kind of manipulating it in this way where it gets like hotter and sexier and grittier as it goes. And so in the last part of the dance break, the harmonies start to like fold on top of each other. And there's like polychords where there's like one chord and then another chord. And it creates a sense of dissonance. And as it gets more dissonant and dissonant and dissonant, it then releases into the vocal right back into the song. And so the idea there was to obviously like build that tension, so that when it releases, it just feels like, thank God, you know, like that's what everybody needs. And so, and that's, you know, I think it's really fun. I think, you know, it was successful in sort of delivering that idea in like the smaller, like micro of it too. There are groups that have their own little gestures and their different movements. And so sitting there and watching them come up with those gestures and those ideas and building kind of what they're doing, allowed me to like make it into sections, and each section is kind of reflective of what that group is and what that gesture is in a way. It's always different for me on each project. There are some times when a choreographer knows exactly what they want and you sit down with them and you map it out and like that's what it is. And then there's some times where they're like, what do you got? Like, what could this be? What, you know, what are some ideas that we can play with? What are some like styles that we can kind of mess around with? The other one in the show is the dance break in Blue Jeans, which, you know, is such a great moment, and Robin is incredible in it. And that's another example too, where it needed to feel like fabric of the song. You know what I mean? I didn't want it to feel like it sent us to like a different place. There was actually a day in rehearsal where I was like, I think we need to do a key change into it. And we did it, and I got a lot of bad looks, but you know, it was, I wanted to try it because you want to feel like we're sort of going somewhere. Right. And it honestly, it didn't work. And so that sort of even solidified more in my brain, like this needs to feel like we're on this train and we have to stay on this train for this dance break. And so how do we do that when we lose all the voices? How do we raise the energy in the orchestra so that it feels like the orchestra can take over and support what Robin's doing with her movements and hit when she hits and turn when she turns and, you know, do all of that stuff that a dance arrangement has to do, but within the vocabulary of Neil Diamond and that song.
Right. I think what you said just a couple seconds ago is important to note, because I feel like when you said that, you know, in rehearsal, you made this suggestion, you explored it, it didn't work. I think it's important to note for everyone out there is that like music doesn't necessarily have to be finalized to hit when you hit rehearsal, right? So a lot of it is still playing just like you would direction or choreography. So I just love that you made that point. I wanted to just call that out a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. I think that, you know, to me, everything is a sketch until it's not. You know, I think that being open and willing to continue to look at something develop and change and being willing to react to that is, to me, the most fun part about this job. I might have said that about every part so far in this interview, but I love being adaptable, and I love like watching really intently what's happening on stage and just like continually asking, is the music supporting it? Is the music doing the best that it can? And if an actor changes the way they deliver a line or the way that they move or the way that they do, you know, walk, or the set suddenly does something, like I want to look at that and say, am I reacting to that? Am I supporting that? And sometimes the answer is no. And sometimes the answer is, oh, actually, what if we did this? And, you know, everybody's kind of have to be on board with that, because you can certainly get to a place where people are like, please stop changing the music every 5 seconds. So you have to be cognizant of it and respectful to people. But yeah, it really, I think it has to be a process, and you have to be really attuned to everybody else's process as well to be effective. You have to always be paying attention to what the director is talking about and what the choreographer is talking about and what the actors are doing and saying. Because that's how you can really make sure that you're keyed into what's really happening on stage.
How about we move into our lightning round?
Yeah, let's do it. So to kick us off, what is one thing in the theater industry that confuses you?
Eating and drinking during shows. I think this, I feel like such a grandpa saying that, but like, sure, like having a cocktail during a show, that's fine. it's like a smell thing too. It's like when you like you're smelling everybody's food, and it's just like it's just like a sensory thing for me.
What are three adjectives that describe your ideal working environment?
Collaborative, positive, and excellent.
Is there something in your process that you have found unique to you?
I think that one of the things that I personally have discovered about myself is the ability to like be really attuned to everybody, for better or for worse. And I think that, like I was just saying before, it does help me really be keyed into the rehearsal room and what's happening in the in every conversation and on stage. Because I think that I want to know what the director is thinking, and I want to know what the choreographer is thinking. I want to know how the actors are feeling when they're singing the songs. You know, I want to be like really keyed into all of that. I don't walk into a room and present a piece of music and say, this is what it is, perform it, because this is what I wrote. I like the feedback, but I also feel like I'm good at sort of intuiting the feedback in a lot of ways.
Do you have any books or resources, podcasts, something that you've found helpful to you in your process, or maybe that you found that you used earlier on in your career to get you to where you are?
You know, I'm like a real nerd. I'm a definite nerd, and I am a constant student and learner. I love reading. I love studying. I mean, I collect books on orchestration, which is like, you know, I'm the person that like paid a couple $100 for like an out of print, like random book from the 50s on like big band arranging. I just, you know, I love it because I just think like there's reading any information on what you do is fascinating, because as you like get along in your career, you start to look at it from a perspective of, I have an opinion about this. Like, I'm reading this and I'm like, I agree with that, or I don't agree with that. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, it's like validating your sort of perspective as an artist. But sometimes you're like, oh my God, I've never thought of that idea. Or like, that's like such a cool perspective that I haven't really thought of. So I really enjoy that. I like the books. And I also am like a real nerd for watching, you know, like music production tutorials on YouTube and on Instagram and stuff like that. I just, you know, anything that I can like find to give information, I think is really fun.
Amazing. Like a masterclass even.
Totally.
Yeah. What is one job you have in the theater industry that you would trade jobs with for 1 week?
I think this is like kind of crazy, but I think I would enjoy being a stage manager. I like the organization of it. I like the people management of it. And I like, you know, when they call shows, how it's the same as conducting. I mean, like when you're conducting a show, you're conducting and the stage manager is calling, and like you are like in concert with them. And so it's similar in a lot of ways to like being the conductor. So I think that'd be kind of fun and interesting.
What's one hobby that you have outside of theater?
Oh, you know, I'm a real foodie. I love cooking. I love restaurants. I love all of it. That's like my other passion in life. I like studied wine a little bit for a little while because I just got real nerdy about it and thought it'd be interesting to learn about the different regions and how it's made and what the different grape varietals and all that, you know. So that's my definite like other hobby slash passion.
What are you looking forward to most about the process of Beautiful Noise here on out?
I'm excited to get into the Broadway theater and feel the space there and feel what it's going to feel like in that theater performing the show, because the Colonial is such a different theater than the Broadhurst. And so I'm excited to like feel the different physical space that the theater is and what it sounds like and what the like different visceral, you know, experience is of it. I've had that a couple times. Like we did Frozen in Denver in like a 4,000 seat theater, and then going to the St. James, it like changed the show. I mean, like truly changed it. So it's a real thing when you move into a new home.
And I'm so excited to see it. Hopefully by the time this airs, I will have seen one of the first previews. But thank you so much for coming on board the podcast and speaking with us today. And is there any way we could find you on social media? Do you want to shout out any of the shows you currently have running?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram. I have a website. And I also have a band that I started in the pandemic called The 1920. And you can find us on Spotify and Apple Music and all those things. It's Colin Donnell and I.
Oh, amazing. We'll link all that in our show notes and on our social media as well. Well, thank you. This was great.
Yeah, thanks, guys. This is really fun.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of Page to Stage. To keep up with us, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Page to Stage Podcast.
And if you're enjoying these conversations, we would really appreciate it if you could take a couple minutes to rate and review us wherever you're listening to this podcast. Until next time.
That's Brian.
That's Mary.
We'll see you later.
Bye.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.